Welcome to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution, one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's episode, we'll discuss the forgotten battle of the American Revolution, the May 1775 Battle of Chelsea Creek. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. After the bloody events at Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, New England militia began to systematically encircle the town of Boston, placing the English garrison, then commanded by Governor General Thomas Gage, under siege. British forces in the town had a navy stationed in Boston Harbor, but provisioning men from the water was a tricky business. The British military had a long-standing practice of supplementing troops' rations with fresh meat and produce that it purchased from local farmers. If these supplies were to be interrupted, General Gage would be forced to depend upon a long and tenuous line of communication to British possessions in Nova Scotia and ultimately back to England. Massachusetts leaders understood that it was unlikely that they could entirely cut off the flow of supplies to the British Army. But if they could significantly cut into it, they might starve the English out of Boston. On May 7, 1775, eager to interdict supplies that might support the enemy, the Massachusetts Committee of Safety passed a resolution ordering the selectmen and committee of correspondence for the town of Chelsea to take effectual methods for the prevention of any provisions being carried into the town of Boston. Unfortunately, the resolution presented something of a problem. The selectmen and committee of correspondence for Chelsea lacked the authority to call on the Massachusetts Grand Army for assistance in implementing the directive. At the same time, local farmers were in a quandary. William Harris, manager of Oliver Wendell's farm on Hog Island, confided to a friend that he felt very uneasy. The people from the men of war frequently go to the island to buy fresh provision. His own safety obliges him to sell to them. But on the other hand, the Committee of Safety have threatened that if he sells anything to the British Army or Navy, that they will take all of the cattle from the island, and our folks tell him they shall handle him roughly. British authorities in Boston knew full well what the provincials were up to, and they took measures to respond. There is evidence that General Gage contemplated a move towards Chelsea as early as May 10th. On that date, a man named Elijah Shaw testified before the Massachusetts Committee of Safety that he had overheard Gage say that the troops would soon make a push either towards Dorchester Neck or Chelsea. Shaw went on to report that the British had visited his farm and had liberated a large number of animals and 5 tons of hay. Despite the provincial threat, General Gage was, in fact, sending out small detachments of 50 men on foraging details at this time. As a result, the Massachusetts Committee of Safety revisited the issue at its session of May 14, 1775. The best way to prevent the animals and hay from falling into enemy hands was to remove them altogether. The mission was entrusted to Colonel John Stark and the 1st New Hampshire Regiment. Unfortunately for the provincial forces, Stark lacked the authority and firepower to carry out the mission. As a result, taking advantage of the disarray, General Gage continued to send out foraging parties. On Sunday, May 21st, he enlisted the support of Vice Admiral Samuel Graves, commander of the North Atlantic Squadron, who dispatched an armed schooner along with 2 sloops to Grape Island, along with a detachment of 100 troops who had been charged with seizing the livestock and hay stored there. Grape Island was incorporated within the town of Hingham, Massachusetts, and was owned by Elisha Levitt, a wealthy loyalist who had previously offered or sold the supplies to Gage. The British sloop's approach alarmed the neighboring towns. General John Thomas, in command of the Massachusetts Grand Army stationed at Roxbury, sent 3 companies to a point of land across from Grape Island, but they were required to wait there lest they be vulnerable to the British while crossing mudflats at low tide. The militiamen opened fire on the island, but given the range, had little effect beyond drawing a response from the British ship's cannons. Eventually, with the rising tide, the militiamen were able to cross in small boats, but by then the regulars had escaped, taking with them what they could. The militiamen contented themselves with setting Levitt's barn ablaze, some 80 tons of hay still inside, and they removed the remaining livestock. Massachusetts provincial leaders scrambled to find a way to prevent further such raids from the British. The Massachusetts Committee of Safety drafted a resolution on May 23, 1775, to the Provincial Congress, urging it to use its authority to secure resources on the Boston Harbor Islands as well as the Massachusetts seacoast. In response, Major General Artemus Ward, Commander-in-Chief of the Provincial Militia, convened a council of war to discuss removing or destroying all supplies on Noddles and Hog Island. Connecticut General Israel Putnam was placed in command of the operation. According to his account, it was unanimously agreed among the general officers that it was absolutely necessary to remove the stock and effects from said island in order to prevent the enemy receiving any supplies of provisions, and accordingly, a party of troops were detached for the above purpose and put under my command. British spies quickly gathered intelligence and passed it on to Gage. In a note to Vice Admiral Graves, dated the morning of May 25th, Gage wrote, "I have this moment received information that the rebels intend this night to destroy and carry off all of the stock on Noddles Island, for no reason but because the owners having sold them for the king's use. I therefore give you this intelligence that you may please to order the guard boats to be particularly attentive and to take such other measures as you may think necessary for this night." Admiral Graves concurred. He recommended landing a guard upon the island as the most probable means of preserving the hay from being destroyed. It may have been this force that Lieutenant John Barker of the King's Own Regiment stationed in Boston referred to when he recorded, 50 men ordered last night did not go on account of the tide not serving. Graves, to be sure, was not concerned with the livestock and hay alone. He had to protect naval storehouses he had set up on the islands. Gage had accurate intelligence about the provincials' plan, but he had been misinformed about the date. The provincials did not move until May 26th, and when they did, it was with a professionalism one would not normally expect from a large body of amateur soldiers from different colonies, who were, for the first time, working together. At 6:15 a.m., a scouting party drawn from several companies of Colonel Samuel Gerrish's 25th Regiment of the Massachusetts Grand Army was dispatched to Chelsea. The group's assignment was not to find the route of march to Hog and Noddles Island. Instead, the group's mission was to secure the route. At the front of the force was a scouting party under the command of Captain Thomas Sprague of Gerrish's regiment. This contingent of 32 men was to act as a picket force. In other words, it was to warn the main column that would follow of any approach by the regulars and to ensure that no civilian was allowed to tip off the British. That night, a force of 200 to 300 men, under the command of Colonel John Nixon, marched out of the provincial camp at Cambridge and proceeded towards Medford, Massachusetts, where they joined another 300 men under the command of New Hampshire Colonel John Stark. In addition to Nixon, Gerrish, and Stark's men, the detachment was bolstered with small detachments of 10 to 15 men drawn from two other regiments. Nixon left Cambridge along the Old County Road, crossed the Mystic River at an old bridge and ford, and proceeded on to Medford, where he rendezvoused with Stark. Together, the 600-man contingent of Massachusetts and New Hampshire militiamen marched out along the Old County Road, through Malden, and on to the meeting house in Chelsea. Exactly how long it took the men to reach Chelsea is not known, but it is likely that Stark and Nixon came upon the meeting house during the early morning hours of May 27th. There, they probably met up with a portion of scouts under Captain Sprague's command, with the rest of Gerrish's force being positioned throughout Chelsea. The 27th of May happened to be a special occasion for British Vice Admiral Samuel Graves. Having recently been promoted to Vice Admiral of the White, he was raising his new colors for the first time. When the white flag was run up at 8 o'clock in the morning, the squadron issued a salute of 13 guns. That morning, too, the HMS Diana, commanded by Admiral Graves' nephew, Lieutenant Thomas Graves, returned from a cruise to Maine. Admiral Graves, who had no children of his own, was known to promote his nephew's interests whenever possible. Once the Diana was safely moored off Noddles Island, Lieutenant Graves reported to his uncle aboard the HMS Preston. At about the same time as Graves was receiving his salute, Stark and Nixon's forces were departing Chelsea Meeting House. Following a small lane leading away from it, they reached Sale Farm between 9 and 10 o'clock, Once at the farm, Stark and Nixon made their final arrangements while waiting for the low tide. And at 11 o'clock in the morning, they crossed Belle Isle Creek to Hog Island. Once there, Stark and Nixon divided their men into smaller detachments to round up the livestock and set fire to any stores of hay they could find. The work progressed slowly, but some 411 sheep, 27 horned cattle, and 6 horses were herded back to the mainland. Sometime during the mid-afternoon hours, a small 30-man detachment was sent across Crooked Creek to Noddle's Island. Amos Farnsworth was a member of the party, and his journal is the only primary source we have for the initial phase of the Battle of Chelsea Creek. Farnsworth relates that the men set one of the house and barn on fire, killed some horses and cattle, brought off 2 or 3 cows and 1 horse. General Putnam explained the rationale for the action, and it was agreed amongst the general officers that if the stocks and provisions could not be got off the said island without great hazard and loss of the American troops, that in that case it would be expedient to destroy or consume the farm, which was accordingly done. The columns of smoke rising above the burning house and barn were the British forces' first indication that something was afoot on Noddle's Island. Captain John Robinson of the HMS Preston noticed those signs shortly after 2 p.m. and alerted Graves, who issued orders to intercept the provincials. Graves wrote, "I ordered the Diana to sail immediately between it and the mainland and get up as high as possible to prevent their escape. And I also directed a party of Marines to be landed for the same purpose." Given the tidal patterns then occurring, Lieutenant Graves, who was not familiar with the upper reaches of Chelsea Creek, faced some tricky navigating. On May 27th and 28th, 1775, the tides actually ran 10 to 11 feet, 2 or 3 feet higher than normal, which would allow the Diana to ascend higher up the creek than she would normally be able to go. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a signal was given to land a squadron of Marines, approximately 170 men, who served variously on the HMS Somerset, the HMS Preston, and the HMS Glasgow. As the Marines formed on the beach, the HMS Diana entered Chelsea Creek, followed by 10 to 12 longboats, and began to make her way upstream to cut off the provincials' avenue of retreat. As soon as she entered Chelsea Creek, the Diana began taking small arms fire from Sprague's company, positioned in buildings and behind stone walls at a nearby ferry. The time of this engagement was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The 30 provincials on Noddle's Island were not aware that the British were moving in on their position. But when they began to withdraw, the Diana, which had reached the mouth of Crooked Creek and had a clear line of sight downstream, began firing grapeshot at them. The Royal Marines arrived at the crossing point as the last few provincials were making their way to Hog Island. Half of the Americans' 30-man contingent, acting as a rear guard, took up a position in a ditch while the rest herded off the livestock. Amos Farnsworth wrote, "About 15 of us squatted down in a ditch on the marsh and stood our ground, and there came a company of regulars on the marsh on the other side of the river, and the schooner, and we had a hot fire until the regulars retreated." During this firefight, 2 Marines from the HMS Somerset were wounded. Having failed to corral the American detachment, the Royal Marines withdrew with their stricken brothers, which left the Diana and the longboats to continue the fight. The sun was beginning to set, but both parties seemed unwilling to call it a day. Stark and Nixon appear to have divided their forces again, while some of the men herded the livestock across Belle Isle Creek and back to the Chelsea Meeting House. It appears another group moved through the marshes, shadowing the HMS Diana as she continued to make her way upstream. When the Diana reached a point opposite Hassie's Landing, Stark's and Nixon's forces attacked with muskets. At a subsequent court-martial hearing, the crew of the Diana testified only that they had proceeded to Hog Island, where they engaged a large number of provincials until they dispersed around 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening. Other historical sources established that the Diana had continued further upstream. At 5 o'clock in the evening, the HMS Cerberus landed her quarter-deck guns, 2- and 3-pounder artillery pieces, which the Royal Marines then hauled up Westhead and positioned it so as to command the channel and cover the area of a Chelsea ferry. Together with nearby ships, the artillery began to bombard the provincial position. In Cambridge, General Putnam heard the exchange commence around 5 o'clock. A short time thereafter, an express rider arrived carrying a request for reinforcements from Stark and Nixon. Putnam wasted no time. He marched his force first to Mystic, having heard that the regulars were landing there, and discovering that the intelligence was erroneous. He then double-quicked his men to Chelsea. Accompanying Putnam's detachment was Colonel James Fry's Massachusetts Regiment and a two-gun section of three-pounder artillery pieces under the command of Captain Thomas Waite Foster. It was now approximately 8 o'clock in the evening, darkness was closing in, and the crew of the Diana found themselves in a dangerous situation. Lieutenant Graves had proceeded up Chelsea Creek almost as far as the Tide Mill. The wind had calmed, and a strong tide threatened to beach him on the mainland. Stark and Nixon established a defensive position on the elevation of Chelsea Neck. Lieutenant Graves thus found himself stranded in a sort of cul-de-sac, taking small arms fire from both shores. In order to rescue the Diana, he called in the longboats and ordered them to take the ship under tow, which made the sailors manning the boats ready targets for the provincials. Putnam arrived with the requested reinforcements at around 9 o'clock and set up Foster's artillery at the new gatehouse. According to civilian eyewitness Elizabeth Hassey, she related that their firing was so intense that it prevented the Diana's withdrawal. James Stevens, a private in Captain Benjamin Farnham's company of Fry's regiment, said simply, "We got down within a quarter of a mile of the ferry and then halted, and our officers went to look out to the place, when as soon as the regulars saw our men, they fired on them. Then they firing begun on both sides and fired very warm." Stevens goes on to say, "We got on top of the knoll and the grape shot and cannon balls come so thick that we retreated back down the road and then marched down to the ferry." The provincial's retreat that was described offered the Diana's crew, and especially the sailors in the longboats, a brief cessation in the hostilities. At about 10 o'clock in the evening, as the slowly moving Diana came abreast of a ferry, she took heavy small arms fire once more. The withdrawing provincials afforded some cover by the broad marshes at the base of Mount Bellingham, had quickly redeployed from Chelsea Neck and Mill Hill to the village and ferry landing. Within the buildings and behind the stone walls lining the stretch of Chelsea Creek, they now waited. The longboat's sailors were particularly vulnerable in two. George Williams and William Croc, both from the HMS Somerset, were killed. With no other option but slaughter, the longboat's men cast off their tow cables and abandoned the Diana. Caught in the tide, the Diana drifted towards Chelsea's shore and ran aground about 60 yards from the ferry landing shortly after 10 p.m. Lieutenant Graves issued an order to deploy a kedge anchor to drag the ship back into the water. The crew tried desperately to haul the ship free from its beached position, but the Diana would not budge. When she began to heel over, Graves ordered her braced. The tide continued to recede, and the bracing failed. When the Diana rolled onto her beam ends, and it was no longer possible to keep the deck and fire the guns, Graves ordered the Diana abandoned. The Britannia, which was now within supporting distance, came alongside to receive the crew. Graves was determined to continue the fight from the Britannia. With daylight and high tide, he planned to reboard the ship, but the provincials did not intend to allow him that opportunity. They set about plundering the ship of its valuables, including its 4-pound cannons, 12 swivel guns, rigging, sails, ammunition, money, and clothing. Just after midnight, now May 28th, the crew of the Britannia noticed fire and smoke rising from the Diana. A party of 12 provincials, including Captain Isaac Baldwin of Stark's regiment and Sam Pratt of Chelsea, had piled hay under the ship's bow and set her on fire. To his credit, Graves attempted to retake his vessel, but was easily repulsed. At approximately 3 o'clock in the morning, the fire reached the ship's magazine and the Diana exploded. Colonel Ephraim Doolittle arrived the afternoon of May 28th with his 400-man regiment to relieve Nixon and Stark and to secure whatever was left of the Diana. His movements touched off a fresh round of artillery fire from British naval ships and the artillery position on Noddle's Island, but for all purposes, the fighting was over. Stark and Nixon, having relieved the British of a sizable number of livestock and several tons of hay, withdrew back to their camps. Estimates vary, but in addition to what was taken from the Diana, the Americans obtained approximately 600 sheep, 40 head of cattle, and horses. Surprisingly, losses for the entire action were extremely light. Three provincials were wounded, two British dead, and several wounded. Evidence suggests that the British underreported their casualties. A Boston resident recorded that 10 regulars were buried there last Sunday evening, May 28th, who were killed in the engagement, but more had succumbed. 'Tis said they had about 30 killed in the whole and a greater number wounded. Although the destruction of the HMS Diana was certainly a feather in the provincial's cap, the 30-man detachment that crossed from Hog to Noddle's Island during the mid-afternoon of May 27th was too small and had too brief a time to do more than initiate the main mission. And so on May 29th, a militia party returned to complete the task of clearing the island of its livestock and fodder. Lieutenant John Barker, still quartered in Boston, recorded in his journal that today the rebels were seen again on the same island. They drove all the cattle and sheep off to the main and set fire to four houses. What is most interesting about the May 29th provincial incursion is the British response. They did nothing. General Gage made preparations for a move towards Noddle's Island, but then must have thought better of it. Once more, on May 30th, the provincials returned to Noddle's Island and proceeded to burn all the structures and supplies located on that island. One of the structures burned was the Royal Navy's Cooperage House. In response, Admiral Graves saw fit to act. Lieutenant Barker reported that while the naval vessels moored in the harbor bombarded the provincials, a schooner was also sent to fire along the shore. The next morning, the Royal Marines were dispatched to Noddle's Island to retrieve whatever was left in the naval storehouse. The provincials did not return to Noddle's Island again until June 3rd, when a Captain Robinson on board the HMS Preston reported that he fired several times at the rebels to prevent them entrenching on the island. The last action related to the Chelsea Creek Battle took place on Noddle's Island on June 10th. On this occasion, a Royal Navy officer wrote that the provincials entered again and burned and destroyed the warehouse, the last building on said island. This final instance of arson provoked no reaction beyond a brief bombardment from the HMS Somerset. Except for an odd small detail sent to gather up hay, neither the provincials nor the British expressed any further interest in Noddle's Island for the duration of the siege. Yet the importance of Chelsea Creek should not be overlooked. For the first time, the provincials took the offensive as they commenced operations to remove livestock and fodder from Hog and Noddle's Island. This new aggressive posture demonstrated that the provincial Massachusetts Grand Army was surprisingly well prepared less than a month after the hostilities of Lexington and Concord, and that its troops were willing to fight to achieve strategic goals. I hope you have enjoyed today's episode of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the Battle of Chelsea Creek, as well as other neat information about Revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com, follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.